Eastern Brady. I am Marjorie Egan. Welcome to hour number two of Boston Public Radio. A little switch up here, Jim.
There is a little switch up. We're going to be talking to Alan Abrahamson, from who's an Olympics guru extraordinaire, about what happened in Switzerland a week or so ago, what happened yesterday in the USOC in Redwood City, and what's going to happen in the future. He apparently is delayed. So in the interim, we'll hopefully talk to him at the bottom of the hour. In the interim, here's an interview we taped earlier this morning. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. So from abortion to lethal injection to the Affordable Care Act, Supreme Court recently ruled on a handful of cases that are charged with medical ethical questions. That, of course, is why Art Kaplan joins us in line. Art is head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU's Langone Medical Center. He's also the co-host of the Everyday Ethics podcast. Hello there, Art.
How are you?
Great.
Oh, so excited to be talking to you, Art, because there's so much going on. Let's start with Jerry Brown, his new vaccination law. It's a pretty tough one. Is it tough enough, and what are the ethics here?
I like the law. I think a lot of people won't, but I think it's a good shift. So what happened was California, like most states, permitted parents, when they sent their kids to school, to opt out or exempt from vaccination requirements on what were called philosophical or religious grounds, as well as health grounds. The California law now says no more philosophical exemption, no more religious exemption. You can still exempt out on health grounds, but it's not the parents who do that. It's got to be a doctor. So I like this because I don't think there are any religious reasons not to vaccinate. There's almost no religion I know of that has any heartburn about religion. That was always sort of a bogus argument. And philosophical just meant I don't like it, or I read something ridiculous on the internet and it scared me, which I never liked. And having the doctor do it gets rid of chiropractors and homeopaths and other people who are exempting kids too. So on the whole, the Disney World measles outbreak scared people in California, and we got the law.
Is this the most far-reaching law of its kind, Art Kaplan?
You're going to love this. Here's a challenge for the two of you.
Yep.
Name the two other states that don't allow exemptions except for health.
Well, it's obviously got to be some place we wouldn't expect. So I would say Alabama and Wyoming.
I'll say Massachusetts.
Ooh, very good.
How'd I do?
West Virginia and Mississippi.
Well, it's the same thing. So
I was going to say Massachusetts. I was way off.
Really? What's that about?
Historically, Mississippi basically looked at this and said, we got to vaccinate everybody, and we got a lot of federal money to do it. And if we don't do it, the feds will pull their child vaccination money away. So we're doing it. And who knows what's going on in West Virginia? I have no idea. But those are the other two states that have the same law. And they've been on the books for at least 20, 25 years, and the number one state for childhood vaccination compliance, Mississippi.
Well, Art Kaplan, I'm down with Mississippi then. In fact, I'd go even further. I don't know why we exempt anybody at all, including these private home-based school kids, unless they have, as this piece points out, some kind of health reason, immune system issue. Mm-hmm. Why exempt anybody?
Well, it's hard to justify because if your child goes to the supermarket or the bus station
exactly.
or the airport, even if they're homeschooled and exposes people to some disease they've picked up, it's still a problem. You know, my view has been, and this is where I get draconian, but seriously draconian, and that is, I mean it. If your kid makes my kid sick, I think you should be held liable. I think you should be sued. That is to say, if I can prove that my kid got measles or my baby got measles from your kid and my baby died because you didn't vaccinate, boy, I wouldn't send you to prison like a criminal conviction, but I think there ought to be some serious financial penalties there.
Well, you know, one last thing about this. I remember, and I don't know, which is why I'm asking you, but you get sick enough with these childhood diseases, measles, mumps, and all this when you're a kid. But suppose you get the measles at 40. Is it worse then or not?
Some diseases like mumps, definitely worse when you're older. Measles, no, I don't think so.
Okay.
But measles is a serious disease. We tend to think of it as, you know, something you get over it.
Oh, you're sick.
No big deal, but you are sick.
Yeah.
And some of the worst cases are really awful. Remember, too, if you don't vaccinate, there are people out there who have immune diseases. They're after a transplant. They're post-chemotherapy from cancer. They can't vaccinate, and you can kill them.
Yeah, okay. Well, I think I'm with Mississippi. I never thought I'd hear myself saying that, but I'm with Mississippi on this one. So we have a whole bunch of United States Supreme Court decisions we want to talk to you about. And as you may know, there's a lot of people who are still, a lot of mainly Republicans who don't like the Affordable Care Act, so-called Obamacare, are thinking about other ways to challenge the rule. And, you know, you're our ethical guy, Art. Is there an
Well, at least in theory, yes.
At least in theory. When you have millions of people getting insured and more to come, now that it's survived a second Supreme Court challenge, is it unethical for people to be opposing this and trying to take away that insurance? And where's the American Medical Association on this?
AMA is okay. They've said, we can live with this. It's fine. Insurance industry, since they're doing okay under this statute, they get more customers with more ability to pay. They're not squawking either. I'd say this. It's unethical to oppose this legislation unless you have something else that you can offer that you could say is better. And to be honest, I haven't heard five words from critics that indicate they have anything to offer. There's a lot of, you know, my plan about restoring choice markets to the what? I mean, it's a lot of nonsense. There's no substantive complementary or alternative ideas. So just killing this and yanking health insurance away from, say, 7 to 9 million people and then saying, I got nothing to substitute for it, boy, that strikes me as hugely unethical. By the way, it also strikes me as politically crazy. So here's a prediction. This issue is going away. This legislation is here to stay, trying to yank benefits from people who already have them in a plan that, well, there's certainly improvements possible. Has definitely been working. No, nobody, particularly the Republicans, are seriously going to try and legislate this thing away.
Okay, so let's turn to another decision. Well, it's not really a decision. It was a stay that could end up to the court taking the case on another medical issue. There are very few abortion clinics left open in the state of Texas. There are 27 million people, and they're roughly somewhere in the 10 to 12 neighborhood. And one of the reasons they've been shutting down is because of some strict requirements passed by the Texas legislature in terms of staffing, office size, requirements around what you have to have at the office and that sort of thing, which basically say, sure, you have a right to an abortion under Roe v. Wade, but we're going to make it so difficult that you can't effectuate. You can't enforce that right. What obligation is there on medical personnel to ensure that if one has a right to a certain kind of care, that they fight to ensure that you have access to that kind of care? And inside, it should be clear, the Supreme Court has not decided yet to take the case. They've just decided that they would stay the decision by a lower federal court, which basically said it's fine for Texas to do this. So for the time being, these handful of abortion clinics will remain open. What's the ethical obligation of the medical world vis-a-vis providing access to a constitutionally protected service?
Well, sadly, I think that's a poorly phrased question.
Well, you rephrase it.
So I will rephrase it.
Please. Thank you.
No one has an obligation to provide anything. This isn't some commie socialist empire. You know, we don't have a right to health care still. We have health insurance reforms that extend out, but no one is obligated to give anything. Even, you know this, Jim, in some towns they close the emergency room and don't replace it. So we don't have a system yet that says you got to give this, you got to give that. But here's my rephrasing of the question. Where is organized medicine and nursing and social work in speaking out when legislators start to say, this is what you have to keep an abortion clinic going. You need this and you need that and you have to certify this. Really? Legislators? When did they become experts on, you know, the safety standards of any clinic? And while I'm at it, where's organized medicine in saying, would you keep the legislature out of my conversations with my patient? You know, all these laws, you got to watch this tape, you got to be told that the fetus is torn to shreds, you have to have this information about, you know, pain and fetal suffering, none of which the patient has been asking for. A lot of which doesn't seem to be confirmed by any science. It's the legislature practicing medicine. And I can't believe that organized medicine isn't crying holy hell about this, you know, just sort of saying, stop trying to use the abortion issue to shape the practice of medicine.
So, by the way, that was the question I intended to ask, Art. I want to be clear there. Okay.
You know, I may have asked you this before, but this is one of my pet peeves, and it's been my crusade, although I've gotten absolutely nowhere with it. To me, one of the things that organized medicine is falling down on the job on, and I think the hospitals in Boston and all these very powerful medical groups, is there should be, for my money, no freestanding abortion clinics at all. Planned Parenthood obviously wants them. They do great work, but they have a vested interest in wanting them because, of course, that's their business. But if you went to your regular gynecologist, or you went to your OBGYN, as a lot of women with good insurance do, who are not like 21 years old, right, if they find themselves unexpectedly pregnant, and get abortions there, everybody should be able to do it in a hospital or in a, you know, a medical clinic where you would have no idea what the woman was going in for and which doctor was doing the procedure, etc. But they don't want the hassle.
They don't want the hassle. These mighty organizations, I think, have turned tail and run away and left the Planned Parenthood to set up these little clinics and so forth. They don't want the demonstrators at the front door, and they don't want the Board of Trustees saying, why are you giving us this bad publicity? They are not doing, they're not showing much courage. However, you know, I still think things are going to change, because I think we're going to see abortion move more toward a pill. Less toward a surgery. And I'm going to be very interested to see, state legislatures are likely to say, you know what, we don't want you sending abortion pills by mail or FedEx or something. Are we going to let them really interfere with that? A lot of people get their medicines, you know, their pharmacy prescription shipped to them, you know, to their door. Are you going to really give that freedom up because the state legislature doesn't want an abortion pill in that package?
Yeah, that is a great question, and that would be a wonderful thing, won't it, if we can get to that point where you don't have
I think it would be safer, earlier. I think even if you're a critic of abortion, it's better to do the procedure earlier. It's safer for the woman.
Yep.
Look, I don't know if I've ever said this on this show, but I'm actually conservative about abortion. I think there are a lot of bad reasons to have abortions. I condemn some of them, but I'm not going to outlaw it. I'm going to let women make their choice. You know, to me, it's a moral argument. I might try to persuade you, not you, Marjorie, but one, a woman, to say, you know, don't use abortion as birth control. Let's get onto the contraceptive side of this. That's better. And I wouldn't like you to use it that way. And I try to use moral arguments to make people change their behavior. But I wouldn't say, you know, let's outlaw abortion because some people have bad reasons to get abortion.
Right. Well, that's being pro-choice, Art, right? That's being pro-choice. You may not personally like it and think it's a good idea, but it's not imposing your views on everybody else.
Right. But I don't say, you know, I think a lot of folks on this issue, they think, oh, well, guys like Art, they just sit around all day and say, yay for abortion. I don't. I see it as morally very, very tough and many, many, as I said, poor reasons to have abortions. But I still think you want to make it safe, and I still think you want to leave it up to the individual to choose what they want to do, even though I might disagree sometimes. But that isn't where we're going. We're having the state legislature act like little doctors in places like Texas. And again, I think it's cowardice.
So, Art Kaplan, there's a third Supreme Court case I want to talk to you about, but since I'm afraid you're going to chasten me if I ask the wrong question, can you tell me what the question should be?
Count on it.
I want to talk about the decision, a narrow decision, 5-4. There was this challenge to all these drugs that weren't working so well for death row inmates, and the contention of the plaintiffs was this leads to an unconstitutional level of suffering, violative of the cruel and unusual punishment provision in the Constitution. And obviously they lost by 5-4. What's my question?
Your question here is, should the Supreme Court tolerate experiments in trying to figure out how to kill people in the name of the death penalty?
That is exactly what my question is.
That was brilliantly put.
Thank you. I'm going to use
In fact, why don't we change roles permanently here? I'll ask and you figure out the silly answers to all this.
So what is the answer to your question?
So it seems to me the Supreme Court can certainly say the death penalty is constitutional and we accept that and, you know, go forward states if that's what you choose to do. However, I just disagree with them on this one. I don't think people know what they're doing. They're botching these executions. It's gotten so bad that a couple of states have just pulled out of it entirely. Until you show, probably using animals, that you can effectively come up with some formula to safely kill people, it's hard for me to say that that ought to proceed. So experimenting on people, in my line of thinking, you know, trying out new ways of new combos of drugs when you can't get the ones that you've traditionally used, or doing new techniques, that's experimentation. And experimentation, you have to try it on animals and show that you can euthanize the mice and that they seem to, you know, go painlessly from this earth. And the court didn't ask that. I don't understand why. I think the whole heat over the capital punishment issue has got the court confused on this issue of modality, and I don't think they got it straight.
You know, ever since I learned about these prisons like the one in Florence, Colorado, where Zohar Tsarnaev is now awaiting, execution eventually, people being in solitary confinement for 23 or 24 hours for like 20, 30, 40 years, and that there are so many people, including teenagers apparently, in solitary confinement.
Yeah, weren't there a couple of guys in Angola and Louisiana who were like, I don't know, 40 years just let out after?
I don't know that this has come before the Supreme Court, but again, and I hate to throw everything on the American Medical Association, but there's people have such respect for what the AMA says in most instances, I think. You know, I wonder why, or maybe they have and I've missed it, they have not come out about solitary confinement. People are becoming mentally deranged in these environments quite quickly. And the
story, our old friends, the Puritans, they set up a number of prisons back in the 17th century, I think it was, maybe 18th, that basically isolated people in a small cell with a Bible, and they learned that people went crazy. This is not news. It's inhumane to have somebody in isolation in a small space. You'll drive them nuts. And for those who don't like or want to see people punished severely for doing terrible things, trust me, solitary confinement for 40 years is way worse. I'd pick getting killed any day of the week over that experience. So the death penalty isn't the worst thing. I think this is. We've seen some protest, I know, from medicine on subjecting young people to this, juveniles. Not sure they've taken a position, I just don't know, on solitary confinement generally. But I think the case is a lock. Boy, I'm opinionated this week. I think it's solid that is cruel and unusual.
Yeah.
It's just too much.
You know, speaking of that, when you talk about young people, we talked a lot, and Marjorie interviewed the woman who wrote the piece in The New Yorker about this Kalief Browder, the young man who was sent to Rikers Island, obviously fairly near you, for allegedly stealing a backpack. No trial, no nothing. Mm-hmm. Ultimately got out after almost 2 years in solitary out of 3 years in jail for, again, stealing a backpack. Then he ends up hanging himself at his parents' apartment. Is other than some, I know de Blasio, the mayor, has talked about some reform. Apparently some is happening. Does that have potential to be a lightning rod on the solitary confinement issue, or is that essentially one and done? They say we're fixing that problem. Now let's move on.
I think it's a one and done. I don't think we've really had a serious hard look at solitary. And, you know, it takes us over to the whole mental health in prisons thing. The biggest health care providers for mental health in the U.S., the prison system of Cook County in Chicago, the L.A. County Jail, jails are full of people who are mentally ill. And we got to really, you know, we deinstitutionalize folks. That's nice. No more Bridgewater State Mental Hospital.
Exactly.
But now they're just in jail or prison, and it makes no sense. It's expensive. They don't belong there. We're not rehabilitating them. I'm not even sure they understand they're being punished, because many of them are too mentally ill to know. So some of them were making mentally ill by too much confinement in solitary, and some of them were mentally ill when they got there. I'm afraid that problem isn't getting the attention it deserves yet.
You know, Art Kaplan, every time we talk to him, trying to decide what my favorite story is, I love this story out of Sweden about blood donors. And we always hear stories about how blood donations are down, whether it's time of year or just in general. And they're doing something so creative and so easy. First of all, they text, apparently, a thank you note to somebody, which is not a big deal. But this is a big deal, and it's so obvious. I can't believe it's not being done, and I want to know if it is in this country. Is when they actually use your blood to save somebody else's life, they send you a text saying, by the way, that blood you gave last week or last month, save the life of a fellow human being, what greater incentive for that person to do it again or to convince their friends and family to do it? Is that, first of all, do you agree with me? I assume you do. Secondly, is that being done anywhere in this country?
Well, that was a well-phrased question.
Thank you. Thank you, finally.
Yeah, it isn't being done here. I like it. I think it's good. By the way, similar thing could be done for organ donation. You know, send a text when, yeah, you know, you see somebody donate an organ. They don't have to know who got it. They can just say, you know, your liver, you know, your loved one's heart or liver,
yeah,
or
great,
corneas help somebody. So I think it's fine. There are two problems, and then I'm going to tell you a happy story about blood. The two problems are, one, we're actually not set up because of our privacy obsessions. It might not be so easy to email or contact somebody after they donated blood. And two, a lot of blood doesn't sort of get used out in the hall to save somebody. It gets turned into all those blood products, you know, clotting factor and white blood cells. And it takes like thousands of blood donations to make some of those blood products. So you don't always know, even though you're doing a lot of good, say, for someone with hemophilia, but it might take literally 1,500 blood donations to make one unit of clotting factor. So a lot of good comes not just one-on-one, but sometimes many people help a single individual. The good news is this. Did you ever hear of a disease called hemochromatosis?
No.
I don't believe so.
So that's a disease where people don't digest or deal with iron in their food very well, and they get iron overdose in their blood. And you know what the treatment is? They have to get bled. It's like the only thing from the Middle Ages that ever turned out.
Oh, my goodness. Do they bring in the leeches?
Well, they don't bring in the leeches, but you do go to the phlebotomist or the person who, the person who normally gives you a blood test, and they take out some blood, and that lets you go forward, and it's all good. But we used to throw all the blood away, and it was because it was considered diseased blood. Probably 15 years ago, I started working with the Iron Disorders Foundation to see if we couldn't say, hey, you know, we're short on blood. These people get bled. And you know what? It's iron-rich blood, so it's like really good for most people. Well, last week, the FDA finally decided to let that blood be used in the blood pool. So hooray for that. I think we'll get a little bit more blood. It's kind of makes sense, but because it had the label of coming from a quote-unquote disease, we couldn't use it for a long time. So we finally solved that one. So there's some good news.
We're talking with Art Kaplan, our medical ethicist. Art, there is this, and perfect for you, obviously, an ethical disagreement between China and scientists in the West over this genetic engineering that's going on over in China. What's the deal?
So there's this group, well, there's sort of an allegation flying around that the Chinese are ethical renegades, that they published a paper about trying to genetically change the makeup of human embryos, maybe as many as 80 of them in a paper using some new genetic engineering techniques, and the whole world sat back and said, hey, you shouldn't be doing that experiment. We don't know what we're doing. No reason to try and change genes in human embryos. And anyway, shouldn't be experimenting on human embryos. I'm not ready to say the Chinese are a bunch of ethical renegades. I think they see the world differently, and we're going to have some kind of a dialogue about this. For one thing, our kind of Judeo-Christian, or more Christian, really, view of the embryo as having moral status, Chinese don't have it. They don't look at the embryo and see potential person or actual person. They just see tissue. So they don't see it like we do. The notion that we shouldn't do these experiments, I grant that, but it's not like we have any agreements here that we shouldn't do those experiments on human embryos using these new genetic engineering techniques. So I think there's kind of a, the Chinese are out of control and they're coming to get us phenomena. I resist that a little bit, but it is true that they don't see things the way we do. And in the future, if we're going to regulate genetic engineering of us, of people, we're going to have a long sit-down chat tete-a-tete with them about what the rules are going to be.
So, Art Kaplan, I wrote down this final question. Let me pull it up. What is on the Everyday Ethics podcast, Art? Wait, I got that right. Art. It says the end, Art. What is it, Art? What is it?
Let's see if I can understand that question. So I think what we're going to actually take a look at is something you didn't ask me about.
What's
it's
that?
The Pope and speaking out on climate change.
Oh, I love it.
I can tell you very quickly, the funniest thing I've heard is a bunch of politicians who all dropped out of science class in seventh grade yelling at the Pope for talking about this because he's not a scientist. It's sort of like, really?
Yeah.
You're kidding me. And as far as I know, I think the Pope has a degree, master's level in chemistry.
Chemistry, so yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, he's a chemist.
Yeah, I think he does. I think he outflanks his critics on the science side. So, you know, my response to the critics is just sort of ethical advice, which is, shut up.
Oh, good.
Art, it's great to talk to you. Thanks.
Art Kaplan.
My pleasure.
Thank you very much, Art Kaplan. Art Kaplan joins us every Wednesday. He is head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU's Langone Medical Center. He's also the co-host of the Everyday Ethics podcast. Coming up, we're going to talk about the bigwigs out in California yesterday from Boston 2024 presenting our bid 2.0. Thank you very much. 2.0 to the Olympic Committee people. Now that you've had a chance to look at it, see what it's going to entail, we're going to ask you what you think about Boston 2024. That's up next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.